this misogyny goes back farther, but we can trace it back to about 3500 BC. So that is ancestor, after family system, after family system, after culture, training and teaching the men and the women to view women in a certain way. Of course, those messages are internalized. How does that affect the way we feel about ourselves?
In a heteronormative culture, how can providers use affirmative therapy to help LGBT individuals rewrite the false messages they've internalized? I'm David Kondos, and we'll answer this with psychologist and activist Dr. Lauren Kasteen on this episode of Recovery Unscripted.
The addiction owns the brain. The brain's going to be kicking out all kinds of reasons why, you know, treatment's a horrible idea. But in the heart, the person knows.
I'm a hugger. I can't tell you how many people have just broke down, grown men, old men, broke down in my arms crying because they haven't been touched for years.
I've done a lot of bad things in my life, but that's not what I am or who I am. That's stuff I've done.
You know, I suffered for a long time, and I don't want anybody to suffer.
First thing people are going to say is, oh, Horsha, he's that football player. But no, I had a mental problem. There's not a doubt in my mind that if I had not gone to seek help, Herschel Walker would be sitting here right now.
Sharing firsthand stories and expert insights from the front lines of behavioral and mental health care. This is Recovery Unscripted.
I'm here with Dr. Lauren Kasteen. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, so let's start by having you tell us a bit about kind of your background, your story, and how you got into this world of psychology and recovery.
Well, I've actually been in this world now for, I've got 20 and a half years of sobriety.
Awesome. Well, congratulations.
Thank you so much. So, and right after that, I jumped into getting my master's in clinical psychology, and then I got my doctorate in clinical psychology with an emphasis in depth psychology. And so for me, that was just like really understanding as deeply as I could what's going on in the psyche, specifically in our unconscious, that kind of drives us without us knowing how or why or, you know, and we end up with all these different symptoms, which one, for instance, is addiction. So I obviously was heavily influenced by having my own addictions. And I don't just have one. So I have what I call like an addictive personality. So once I got rid of the drugs and alcohol, really, really, you know, imperative, a lot have popped up, but we can get into that over time. And I've worked on those. And so, you know, right, like as soon as I got my master's, I was actually hired by the treatment center where I'd gotten sober to start doing like weekend therapy. So it was just basically because I understood addiction, and then I was going on for further education. And at that time, there wasn't as many treatment centers, there wasn't as many therapists in the field. It was more, case managers and things. So I kind of just jumped in, got my feet wet, learned how to run groups, all of that, while furthering my education, getting my license, getting all the hours and experience and supervision I could as a clinical psychologist. And then I just went into a number of different directions. Like I've always had a private practice, and that scaled in size depending on what else is going on. But I realized that I always had to do other things. So, I worked in treatment centers for a long time. And then I was brought on to Antioch University, and I helped build a whole program on LGBT affirmative psychotherapy. So that was a master's program there. So I was one of the co-founders and started to get really into How do we heal the trauma of growing up as an LGBTQ person in this world? And this was back in 2006, so we're still fighting for marriage equality. Like, it's not yet hit the scene as something that a lot of people are on board with. And so, and also I had had my own huge challenges of coming out. Like, it just, I came of age in the 80s. It was a really tough time to be a lesbian, and at the time I was identifying as bi, and it was not fun. Okay, it was hard, and
was that here in California?
It was here in California. Oh yeah,
well, think it'd be a progressive,
right? And really, I went to UC Santa Barbara for my undergrad, and I came out as bi there. And the Southern California folks were horrible and didn't treat me well and talked badly about it. And all the Northern folks were cool. So I really saw the divide at the time, you know, in our state. But so I really had to get into the right therapy around my own issues, around my sexual orientation. And that was an affirmative approach. And that changed my life as well. So it was like another level of like healing. First was the getting sober from drugs and alcohol, then looking at what we call like internalized homophobia, what I've later called internalized lesbian phobia for lesbians or queer identified women, because we've internalized misogyny and homophobia. So we have like the double component. And then as a multicultural piece, you know, if you're a person of color, then you've
it's
got
another
the
layer.
Right, yeah. Another yeah. layer, and kind of like really always being mindful of that and cognizant of how that affects one's sense of self, ability to even like yourself, like what, you know, and how that can really deeply influence using, right? All kinds of different using, medicating, so from drugs and alcohol to, for me, it turned out I've had some workaholism. I then dealt with a lot of love addiction stuff. And attachment issues and dysregulation and things like that.
So your mind was just looking for whatever that next thing was,
yes,
as soon as you figured out the previous thing. Yeah,
100%. And I have to say that for me, you know, when I did get sober from drugs and alcohol, and I jumped into the 12-step program and recovery in that way, and also did, you know, group therapy and was getting my PhD in therapy. And
it's a lot. Yeah.
You know, just because I had that much to kind of heal. I also jumped into work. And I have to say it helped. Like, finding meaning and finding a purpose and, like, being of service as a job was, like, really, really helpful in a way. And I'm not saying that's what everyone should do, but for me, that was really...
That was part of your recovery.
It was definitely part of my recovery of not, like, picking up again.
Let's dive into some of this stuff a little deeper. So you're here at the conference, Innovations in Recovery. You're going to give a presentation, Why Affirmative Treatment is an Imperative Component of Helping LGBTQ+ Clients. So let's start by having you just kind of describe, what does affirmative treatment for this population mean to you?
So what it means to me is looking into, A, how does a heteronormative or heterosexist society affect an LGBTQ person even before they know what their identity is? Because we're growing up in a society that's for straight people.
Right.
And for... cisgender people. So what is that like? So, you know, for people, just to break it down really basically, I say, you know, if you're left-handed, this world is created for right-handed folks. That's what it's like for us, right? Like, the whole world is geared in this way. And it has a deep effect. Now, if you are then raised in certain areas of the country and it's deeply religious and that religion is deeply homophobic, then you can have another layer of trauma around that. I, for myself, my mother was really homophobic, so that was a big piece of, like, my own challenges of coming out, and also just the messages I got, that it was not okay, and that I just... So all of this, so it looks at that. You know, it really looks at it from that lens, and then also looks at not only that kind of oppression or discrimination, but it also looks at the invisibility. So things are getting better. I always say they're getting better, but we'll also take like three steps forward and then two steps back. Suddenly, you know, there's not that much lesbian representation on media again. So then, you know, a group actually has to form and start saying, okay, if you're not going to put lesbian characters in shows, we're going to have to write the shows ourselves. You know, there's just, it just ends up happening, you know. So the invisibility is very much of impact. You don't see people that represent you or represent the diverse population and the opportunity, really, like, of how many ways to live in the world.
And so subliminally, that just sends a message of, this is not normal because you're not seeing it.
Exactly. So that is another component. And then also of getting the messages. And, you know, we're talking about all these different generations, right? So, of course, the younger people are saying it's easier. Yes, that's true in certain parts of the country. There are other parts of the country that are still completely discriminating, homophobic, LGBTQ-phobic, so on and so forth. So we want to be really careful to, if you kind of live in a bubble, to not, you know, sort of think that that's everywhere.
Like if it's getting better for you, it might not be getting better for everyone?
Exactly. Yeah, that's very true. So the idea is that we really look at how do we internalize these messages. So as we were saying, you know, subliminally, you get these messages that if it's not what you see, it's not normal, or it shouldn't exist, or what have you. Then you internalize those messages, and that can be fed into the psyche at a very early age of, like, that's wrong. So when you start realizing that might be who you are, you're starting in the questioning phase and things like that, then you're going to equate that with being wrong, and then you're going to equate your sense of self.
Right. I was going to say, yeah, that affects your sense of self.
Yeah, as bad and wrong and things like that. So it's a big part of the affirmative piece is looking at that, deeply looking at that. Really, the coming out story for us is a big deal. So it's really important for a trained professional to know that and to kind of make that part of the story. And a thing that I always say, and I'll be talking about in my talk tomorrow, is as a trained professional, and look, there's not a lot of schools that teach this, right? So, don't let your clients be the ones that teach you. Like, it's really important we get informed, you know, ourselves, and we be the ones that are competent, culturally competent. Another piece that's really important is in the mental health profession, is to know your own privileges and your own biases. So what area you grew up in, what messages did you learn? And so if you're a straight cisgender identified person, like, what privileges do you have that you're not really aware of that your client is not going to have at all? Same if you're white and you're working with someone, the person of color, things like that.
Yeah.
So those,
just not being blind to that.
Yeah. And just being really, and I have to say that this is a process. Like, you know, I personally work on understanding my own white privilege. And it's not like it's just, oh, okay, I understand intellectually that I have white privilege, so then I'm done. it's sometimes something, I'll be reminded of something like the recent white savior complex in movies, and I'm like, oh, wow, I actually had to be taught that because it's so ubiquitous, and it's not, as a white person, it's not something that I would ever see stand out. So that's the same if, you know, oh, most of the characters are cisgender white men saving the world. Like, how is that going to affect all of us that aren't that? So really thinking about that. And then kind of, so there's a psychoeducational piece.
For the therapist.
Yeah, for the therapist, exactly. And then they bring that into, so if it's a treatment center, bring it into your curriculum. If it's one-on-one, kind of be up on stuff and then help your client along the way. And then, of course, really looking at, and when you educate someone about what's going on inside of themselves, then really sort of looking for it, you know. the inner critic or the symptoms or not feeling good enough or perfectionism or all these things that can kind of rise up, or chronic relapse, or, you know, what's behind that chronic relapse, really looking at seeing what piece of that has to do with being LGBTQ. Not the whole piece. I'm not saying the whole piece, because obviously addiction and any sort of addiction is complex and there's many components to it, but make sure that that is pieces in the slice of pie, you know, because if that's overlooked, it's a big problem. I know I've worked with a lot of LGBTQ folks who have come from treatment centers that didn't even ask, like, the sexual orientation, either in the intake or there was just something that let that client know maybe it wasn't safe to come out. And so it's really hard to stay sober if you're not in a place where you feel like you're obviously can be yourself.
And so you touched on a little bit, but if you could go back and kind of describe some more of that landscape of growing up in the heteronormative culture, some examples of the big and small traumas that can come out of that.
So a big trauma is, you know, you're bullied. So say your gender expression is different than what the average kid in your school is, and you're targeted. Right? And you're bullied day in and day out. That's going to be a big trauma, right? If you grow up in an environment where there's a violent, abusive person in the house, and then they use, LGBTQ slurs at the same time as they're being aggressive and violent, that's going to be a big trauma. Little traumas are kind of the ones that we were just talking about, because those are the little cuts that are like, it's the invisibility, it's the lack of mirroring, it's the being in church and hearing that it's a sin. You know, it's sort of the ones that are not as obvious, but are going to be sinking in daily, and they add up. Exactly. So, for instance, I was not raised religious at all. I always say that my family's religion was capitalism.
So, oh boy. Yeah, right.
It was.
Is that a California religion?
I don't know.
Thing?
My dad went to Harvard Business School, and it was all about, like, you know, capitalism and making money, and that's kind of what it was, you know, and there was no religion. So I didn't get that, but my mother grew up in a conservative world, and she just really adopted kind of a conservative, more closed-minded look at things. So even though it was okay to have her decorator may have been gay, and we drove through Greenwich Village and sort of said, oh, this is gay, these are where gay people are, everything else was not okay. And then when she started to suspect things about me, she started saying very derogatory things. She didn't get super angry. One of the things she said to me was like, are you sure you should join a sorority going into undergrad? And I didn't want to join a sorority, to be honest with you. That wasn't my thing. I was like a wild, pink-haired kind of rebel type, right? I'm like, yeah, I'm going to go to a sorority, right? But, it was just a little dig there. And it wasn't like having a conversation. My parents didn't know how to communicate. So it wasn't like we sat down and said, okay, I saw you with this girl. What's going on? Can we talk about it?
Yeah.
It's like...
She didn't really want to know. It was just a jab.
It was a jab, and it was very shaming. And I felt shame anyway in certain ways. And I was very... So that's a kind of trauma, you know? And it makes it very clear, okay, I can't be myself. And let me just continue to hide and be sneaky. And, you know, that's what addicts do. We're really good at that, and we learn that early on. So it's not a great thing to be added through. So you're sneaky anyway because you want to smoke or try, you know, a drug or try a drink or something like that. And you maybe have problems with authority and all kinds of things as a child. And then on top of it, you're going to start hiding other things. So compound.
Right. Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It once that becomes more of part of your life, then that can spill over into addiction, into sobriety, and it just becomes more natural feeling for you.
Right? It's very, I think, and I've worked with so many folks, it's very hard to undo, even in recovery, the sneakiness, because it can be so ingrained of like, this is the only way that I can do
things.
That's
how I've gotten by this far.
Yeah, not without getting shamed. Like, so if I want to make sure that I'm not going to be shamed by someone or judged by somebody or, you know, told I can't do that or whatever, like, I'm just going to figure out a way to do it.
Yeah, yeah. And so looking at the affirmative therapy, I think LGBT issues are becoming, you know, more well-known or more addressed. And so a lot of treatment providers are saying, oh, we have LGBT friendly. Right. So what's the difference there? Why is affirmative different, able to address these issues in a better way?
I'm so glad you asked that, because one of my other talks actually addresses that directly. But I've changed this a bit around. So friendly is, okay, how I always love to preface that is psychotherapists are some of the kindest people in the world, right? I mean, we get into this field because we genuinely want to help people. It's not for the money, right? So it's like, I really want to help someone. I'm really supportive and empathic and open and stuff like that. That's great. That's a wonderful start. But that is not enough. So friendly might be like, oh, it's fine if you're gay or lesbian or coming out or what have you, but then having zero training on what is the internalizations of the phobias, zero training on heteronormativity, on the invisibility we were talking about. Another component is our history. So history, her story, and their story is like what I like to call
it. Okay, describe that.
History is for the male component, okay. History, and then their story is for the trans and non-binary folks, right? And just, so one of the classes that I helped develop and then taught for many years and then I brought into a treatment program that I helped develop in LGBTQ affirmative track was bringing in, you know, all the LGBTQ folks that have been around since we can really, you know, sort of track it and saying, hey, this amazing person like Walt Whitman was a gay man. And he had a life partner for 20 years, and they were in love. And would you know that? I mean, he's one of the most famous poets of United States history, but nobody, you know, it's not. So it's not taught in the schools. There's different states like California that have passed acts to actually teach it, but then they don't because it's really hard to get some teachers to actually teach it.
Sure.
And it's really hard.
Hard to implement.
Very hard to implement. Thank you. Well said. So, it's just, it's again that invisibility, not feeling like we have people that have contributed to civilization. I have to tell you, this is really one of the most empowering parts of affirmative therapy that I practice, is really getting people to study what our ancestors have done before us and how part of civilization they have been. And realizing that we've always existed and we will always exist, and we're not just something that, it's not like a choice or a, you know, it came around when the minute the
just
word
a
was
modern fad.
Yeah. And it didn't just come around when the word was developed. Like when we do look into ancient history, it's from an LGBTQ lens. So it's not like saying, okay, well, that person identified as lesbian. Obviously, we don't know. Or were they identifying as trans? No, they didn't have that language yet. But obviously they were this or this or this and that, and here's the story that we have. And so that a friendly therapist is not going to know all that. They're not going to bring that into the room. They're not going to bring that into the treatment. Another piece is, you know, they may have a very basic intake paperwork where my paperwork has all kinds of choices on there for them to answer, and it immediately says, oh, this person is aware of different pronoun choices and different identifications from gender expression to identity, you know, all of it.
Yeah, and just kind of battling that invisibility.
Yeah, again. So the friendly piece is it's they're going to be very open and loving and let me help you and, you know, sure, I'll hold your hand through this, but they're not going to know how to do all this. Even the coming out process is not going to be necessarily something. Now, I know there will be LGBTQ folks that are not affirmatively trained that may be in our community, but they also may not be trained specifically in this approach. And what I've also found, along with teaching the history and their story, is really getting into the internalization messages, right? These internalized phobias. So it's a there's homophobia out there. When you internalize that, how is that deeply impacting you daily? How is that, you know, affecting your desire to pick up? Because suddenly something is triggered, you know, you're not feeling that great inside. You cannot tolerate the feelings. There's a difficulty in regulating whatever you're feeling inside. And so I'm going to pick something up.
Coping with that. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Numbing, like get this feeling, you know, I mean, it's so. This has helped me lead to another thought. When you grow up in a world like ours, where it's so challenging to be different, especially around sexuality or gender, which is such a hot button for people that, you know, have so much phobia around it, right? Your ability to regulate is going to be affected because you're going to have a harder time building that resilience as you're growing up if you know you're different or if you're teased or if you're bullied or if your family is not accepting of you being different or if you're shamed or, you know, all these kind of things. So the resilience and the ability to tolerate uncomfortable feelings is a big part of being able to stay sober. So my talk is really about when we go in this affirmative lens, we're starting to build internal resilience. We're starting to build a capacity to tolerate being uncomfortable more often. And that helps us not only stay sober, but be able to regulate our emotions and have a stronger emotional recovery, if that makes sense.
Because that's, you need that for the addiction recovery.
Yeah. Yeah. And you need it for life, right? And, you know, it's just very helpful as you get out there in the world as a sober person. And now you've also dealt with this piece of you that has been so discriminated against or invisible or denied or repressed or whatever. And now you've built the internal psychological muscle to sit with it, and then you can sit with feelings and sit with triggers and sit with challenging relationships and all the things that really, when you get out there in the world, are things we have to deal with all the time.
So I wanted to touch on your book, Lesbian Love Addiction, Understand the Urge to Merge and How to Heal When Things Go Wrong. Introduce us to that. What are some of the unique challenges? I know we've been talking about kind of LGBTQ more in general. What are some of the challenges in the lesbian community you're seeing there related to, you know, love addiction, emotional health, that kind of thing?
So when you have two women together, it's a totally unique dynamic, right? So there's a couple of things that go on. Women who meet and have chemistry with each other and then also have attachment issues and trauma from, you know, the piece we just talked about, the lesbian piece, all of that piece, and say their relationship with their mother was not that healthy, for instance, or the mom was not that accepting or whatever it was, and they don't really have the resilience and the emotional stability inside, they're going to really, when they have chemistry with someone, they're going to just, that what we call is merging.
Dive right in.
Oh, yeah. You know, the U-Haul joke is there for a reason.
That? What's that?
What does a lesbian bring on a second date?
A U-Haul?
Yes.
Another joke? Okay. Wow. Yeah. I haven't heard that one.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah. It's really good, and it's actually true.
Yeah.
So, you know, we don't have the norms we have to worry about. No one's like, oh, God, is the guy going to call me again? Like, there's none of that sort of traditions or, you know, there's none of that sort of constricting us. So a lot of us just do whatever we want. And the chemistry is really, can be really intense.
And that feels good.
Like, yeah, it feels
like
good.
At the, in the time, yeah.
It feels really good.
I mean, you know better than I do, but yeah.
No, but you're right. It's a good point.
Yeah.
So love addicts have a couple things going on, which is an addiction to the falling in love process. And the mistake is mistaking intimacy for intensity. So the intensity, everyone thinks is intimacy. So suddenly you're feeling very intimate with someone that you actually don't know very well. And you dive into a relationship. It doesn't have the foundation of a relationship that of getting to know each other and really getting to know whether you're actual fit. And then each person will have insecure attachments when this happens. So one might be more anxious and the other might be avoidant. And eventually it's going to be like a disaster. Like,
because it'll catch up with you.
And it's epic proportions. Like, it's just like the draw, you know, there's a lot of heartache and drama and pain. And, you know, the breakups are horrible. They're very painful. And then some folks can't handle it. So then they try to get back together. And then that, you know, it's, and they think it'll work the next time because you get the feeling, good feelings back again. And then it doesn't. And then maybe you just go back to, you just date somebody else as soon as you're recovered. And it's actually just like the last person, just in a different body. So there's a lot of ways that it comes out. I personally had this issue. I had to go to a number of different treatment places to get better. And then through that came the book. So it was like another part of my catharsis. So I was like reading everything I could out there on love addiction. There was a lot of great stuff, but nothing was geared towards women who love women. It was all he, she, so I had to do all this translating, and I said, I'm tired of translating. Let's get something that's directly focused for us. And at the same time, I also brought in the idea of the female brain. Now, I know the female brain is controversial. There's some feminists that say we don't want to do that, but the bottom line is there are aspects of our brain, of a cisgender female brain, and there is studies now showing a trans female brain is closer to, as much, much more similar to a cisgender female brain than a male brain.
So what's the controversy? I'm not familiar with that.
Well, there are some feminists that believe that if we say the brain is our brains are different, that will be used against us. Okay. It's like, oh, well, that's why you're weaker or all these different things. Well, no, it's why we're a little different from each other.
Yeah.
And some of those things are really great, and some of them are not so great. So we're very relationally oriented. So you get two women, relationally oriented, can't wait to be in a relationship, love the high of it. So those are all the components. I kind of brought that all together.
Excellent. Yeah. And then I read you're working on a second book?
Yes.
So that this one is about internalized misogyny and how to heal the trauma of growing up in a sexist world. What can you tell us about it?
Yeah, so obviously you can see kind of a theme here. I like to work on sort of the internal messages that we get growing up. I'm also a feminist and an activist in ways, but at the heart of it, I feel always that as long as we're working on healing ourselves, the world will continue to get better in these areas that needs to get better. And I had written in my dissertation, I had done a lot of research on where did the patriarchy start and where did this shame-based society start and how did we get so misogynistic? Where did this come from? Where does this hatred of women come from? Like, so my dissertation took me into this whole thing, and then I kind of put it
as... Guessing that's all the way back.
Yes, right.
I don't know where you'd find the start of that.
Yeah. 3500 BC was a good place to start, right?
Yeah.
And then I put it to the side and I started doing all these other things I'm focusing on, as I've been telling you. And then the election started. Now, no matter where you are on the side of the election, of the 2016 election, what struck me the most and where the aha moment and where this book again reemerged to be born was when I saw the misogyny when the first woman tried to run for presidency. I was blown away at the way sexism and misogyny was used to fight her
in
campaign.
Different standards.
Yeah, different standards, from The Voice to whatever it was, right? And we're seeing it again. There are people that are really following what's going on now and noticing that there's, again, different standards for any woman that's running for the nomination. So again, I that's when I was like, okay, my book, my dissertation needs to become a book. But it was 10 years old at that point. So I've been working on modernizing it. There's so much more information now. But really getting to the root of, like, this misogyny goes back farther, but we can trace it back to about 3500 BC. So that is ancestor after ancestor after family system after family system after culture, training and teaching the men and the women, all people in our world, to view women in a certain way. Of course, those messages are internalized. How do those affect, how does that affect the way we feel about ourselves? And honestly, a big piece of it is how we end up treating each other. So, you know, the sisterhood piece is very big and it's very powerful. And then there's a part of it that, like, women are not good to each other. So kind of examining that and looking at the women that do side with men that have been, you know, proven to be sexual predators, like, what's going on there? So it sort of kind of examines and explains and looks at a psychological lens of all of that.
Wow. Okay, a lot to unpack there. So good luck finishing the rest of the book.
Yeah, yeah, sounds great. Thank you.
So we'll wrap up with this final question. Everyone who gets up every day, works in this field, gives themselves to this type of service, they have their own personal reasons for wanting to do that, because it's hard work, it's draining at times. Could you end by summing up why this mission is so important to you?
Oh, gosh, I love that question. It's really hard to answer. It's just a calling. Like, it's, you know, before I got sober, I couldn't figure out what I wanted to do with my life. And the minute I realized that it was about helping people understand their own psyche and understanding what's going on inside of themselves and why they make decisions that they do and how they can change that, how we can actually become more empowered and manage our lives differently and really live the life that we want to live. It's amazing to be on the journey with folks. I mean, it's an honor and a privilege to be able to walk this journey with people and help them kind of wake up and get on the path, really, like a path of, like, self-awakening.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a good point that you would think, or in, you know, on the surface, that whoever that person is, they're going to understand their psyche better than anyone. But a lot of times we're blind to our own, who we are, what's going on in our head.
100%. And so really, it's such a great point. I love to help people figure out what their truth is by having that objective, trained eye to help them go inside and figure out what is going on.
Dr. Lauren Gustine is a licensed psychologist, author, activist, and educator based in Los Angeles, California. To find more resources from her about LGBT affirmative therapy, women's empowerment, and her books, visit drlaurengustine.com. You can also follow her on Twitter at @drlaurengustine. As always, this podcast is powered by Foundation's Recovery Network and produced, written, and edited by me, David Kondos. If you haven't yet, be sure to connect with us on social media to get a look at what we have coming up. We're on Facebook at Recovery Unscripted Podcast and on Twitter at Recov Unscripted. Thanks for listening, and I hope to see you right back here for the next episode of Recovery Unscripted.